Good morning. My name is Margaret Walkover, and I am work with Alameda County Behavioral Health Care Services. We're going to be talking about taking action on the local level. I'm wondering how many of you think about or provide services to or work with in any way people who are Medicaid beneficiaries? A few. Good. Because that's what this presentation is about. We're looking at trauma and Medicaid beneficiaries. I wanted to frame, this is not a research-based presentation, it's a framing presentation. I wanted to start off by talking about what trauma is and what it's not, that it's an experience that occurs within relationships, that an experience that creates power differentials within a person, disrupting their sense of safety, trust, connection, undermining self-efficacy, and interferes with people's ability to reconnect with their strengths. It's viewed by many researchers as a core event that impacts all subsequent stages of personal development. Much of what I'm going to say is going to provide the background, the framework for what was presented in these other research presentations. Trauma is experienced across all socioeconomic, cultural, and ethnic demographic groups. It has a ripple effect with adaptive behaviors and beliefs that spans generations. And don't want to ask personal questions, but think about the trauma that's been in your family. That might have gone back generations through immigration or economics or discrimination, and this will feel very personal to you. Trauma will impact multiple seemingly unrelated life domains, and this is the piece that I'm drawn to in my work, that symptoms of trauma often look like mental illness and substance use. And examples are depression, disassociation, negative auditory hallucinations, hypervigilance, self-injury. All of these can be related to trauma. And it's also misdiagnosed as physical illness. The physical illness is a real diagnosis, but we're looking at what the cause is. We want to also address that. So symptoms of trauma manifest as coping mechanisms in adulthood that put people's physical health at risk. And here I bring up the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experience Study. People who exhibit severe symptoms as a reaction to past experiences with trauma, are telling people, other people, that they need help. The symptoms can be understood as attempts to survive and attempts to cope. This is a more compassionate way to look at symptoms. There's two categories of trauma intensity. Single episode or complex, most of what we talked about here was complex trauma. Single occurs at one place at one time for a defined period. Complex occurs over longer periods of time. And then we come to the non-Medicaid population, which I assume is most of us. The Adverse Childhood Experience Study, the ACE study. How many have heard about the ACE study? Okay, so we know about that and how important it is. Trauma asks us to reframe everything, especially working on the local level in a large public behavioral health care department like I do. Trauma-informed care shifts us from asking what's wrong with you to what happened to you. It asks providers who work with people that have some trauma experiences to nurture and build their own mental health. But the kicker for us on the local level is trauma asks service delivery systems to do business differently. So principles across trauma-informed care approaches. Five principles, safety, and basically to put it like in human terms, if you are a trauma survivor, what do you need in order to feel comfortable enough to engage in services and to feel good enough in order to take care of yourself? You need to feel safe, trustworthiness, choice, empowerment, and collaboration. Bedrock principles that people who've gone through trauma need in order to do better. So for people that work in trauma, there's two kinds of strategies. And most people who are direct service providers focus on the first one. What kind of treatment modality can I offer that will help people who've been through a war or who have helped people that who have immigration trauma or have been to jail and have that kind of trauma. And then there's the trauma-informed care, the broader trauma-informed care framework that deals with system and program interventions and can also influence policy. So the first strategy is more familiar to many of us, perhaps. They're evidence-based interventions designed to treat the consequences of specific exposures. And here, they're just the... So these at the bottom are some examples. CBT, EMDR, seeking safety. It emphasizes emotional safety for providers and survivors. They're most effective when offered in programs administered under the principles of trauma-informed care, which we haven't talked about yet. And trauma-informed care is the title of the talk, right? So there's a point being made here. So we're going to talk about trauma-informed care, and this is the definition, an earlier definition from SAMHSA, and this is how it goes, is that the staff of a program, organization, or system is trauma-informed, which they kind of define as people understand the impact of trauma on clients' physical and mental health. They're aware that traditional services and programs may use policies and procedures that make their health worse, typical bureaucratic ways of doing business. And that this is the most important part. They're willing to respond by fully integrating knowledge about trauma into policies, procedures, practices, and settings. And this is what the initiative did in Alameda County that I'm going to talk about at the end of the talk. So really, one of the bedrock questions is, what helps trauma survivors? And will this work? Will integrating trauma interventions on the system and program levels really help? How many of you are direct providers? Probably not that many. Oh, we have a few. So this probably resonates. Well, what supports therapeutic change? And so I'm married to a psychologist. So this is how I came across this. And there's psychologists that work in the behavioral healthcare division that I'm in. So Lambert did a common factors meta-analysis of 40 years of outcome research to figure out what supports therapeutic change. And 15% was explained by the technique, which leaves 15% for a client's sense of hope and expectancy, 30% for the relationship with the provider, just the relationship, and 40% for what he called extra therapeutic variables, which could be the client's temperament, if they have a sense of humor or not, amidst everything else they're going through, how resilient they are, their socioeconomic status, recent life events, and health status. And so if you're talking about the social determinants of health, it's right there. So if you're talking about helping people that have gone through trauma, there's things that we can do in addition to clinical interventions that will help them, like peer support and a few other things. So trauma-informed care supports therapeutic change. And I just made this point. And trauma-informed care also addresses vicarious trauma experienced by staff. How many of you are aware of what the average provider goes through who's working with a population in a high-risk situation that's crisis-oriented? Really? Yeah. I mean, it's a very stressful job, and we know that providers generally bring their own stress into these work settings. We also know that the work settings themselves, generally speaking, aren't very supportive of the providers. So we know that staff members are only able to offer the therapeutic relationships. This is the part they actually can control in helping someone the most. They can only offer these relationships that are characterized by these trauma-informed care principles when they're working in an organization that feels to them safe, trustworthy, where they have choice in their job, where they feel collaborative with the folks they work with, and at least someone empowered. Do any of you feel this way about your jobs? So my point's made, right? It's a high bar. It's a high bar in the society that we live in. So how do we put trauma-informed care into practice? So here's some good questions to ask about safety and trustworthiness and choice and collaboration and empowerment. Some answers that we actually did in our county. Physical environment, we have a whole procedure called a welcoming toolkit, a self-assessment, where we help providers validate when they have a welcoming environment, because many providers don't even acknowledge it. They don't realize the impact it has on their clients. So that lobbies and offices are welcoming, they're decorated to reflect the cultures of clients who seek services, they have access to water, access to bathrooms, which actually in a public mental health setting, access to water and bathrooms is an issue on the ground. staff that reflect the backgrounds of clients who are seeking services, staff who are encouraged to take care of themselves, and in a way, this is really important, policies and procedures, including assessments, are designed to engage clients in ways that feel safe, collaborative, and comfortable. If you walk into an office and you are already feeling emotionally dysregulated, and you're treated like an object, and you feel alienated, it's going to increase your emotional dysregulation. So there's ways that offices can work to help people. So how are you going to do it? You're going to identify a hot team and to do an organizational self-assessment. So there's lots of great. The good news is that there's lots and lots of resources for organizations to learn how to implement trauma-informed care. The ACEs Connection website has 50 trauma-informed care toolkits. So there's a lot of resources. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the Medicaid population. Now that we know about trauma, that the Medicaid population has been exposed to complex trauma in a very deep way. And 90% of public mental health clients have multiple experiences of trauma exposure. And under Medicaid expansion, federally qualified health centers and primary care physician practices offering healthcare homes are going to be under pressure to engage new Medicaid beneficiaries with mental illness or substance use issues. They'll probably have financial responsibility for the management of their care. Trauma-informed care is an approach that we can share. Mental health, the community can share with the primary care, our primary care colleagues. It can help anchor our collaborative relationship with them, as well as helping the clients. So it's a tangible resource, and it'll help our clients feel more comfortable seeing their physicians. I'm at the end. I come from a very large public behavioral health care organization, a county organization in San Francisco, Bay Area, and we want to do something about this. And so we had a visioning group that was made up of thought and practice leaders from our client, family, and member and provider communities. And this project was funded because of a senior leader's personal experience with trauma. We designed a study to increase our knowledge of what works in our county. What kind of practices are currently being done in our county to support people who have experienced trauma? We want to develop a low-cost, easy-to-learn, easy-to-use resource. We wanted to recommend a strategy to sustain the effort. So we completed the inventory of the trauma-specific interventions and also the trauma-informed care that was used in our system. We did a stratified sample. This is actually really sophisticated for public behavioral health. This is science for them, that we would actually do this in a systematic way. So we did it by age group, by ethnic group, and by continuum of services. And we found high rates of vicarious trauma and compassion fatigue from providers. We also found that 50% of our providers had trained their staff in trauma-specific interventions, and 80% were knowingly or unknowingly using one or more trauma-informed care practices, which gave us one of our next steps was to do a more assertive campaign to teach people about the importance of these basic practices. So these were the healing practices that were used by our clients and family members. The method was to build on what was learned on phase one and develop that tool. So our contractor developed a website for us that has a resource for providers, for family members, and for clients. A trauma 101 workshop to explain what trauma is, to validate the good work people are doing, and to connect them with centers of excellence in our county. We had developed a welcoming toolkit, which is written from the perspective of the client, and it's a self-assessment checklist that's congruent with those five principles of trauma-informed care, and with research on wellness recovery, cultural competence, and co-occurring disorder practices. And the contents of the welcoming toolkit is simple. We try to make it really simple. How do procedures make me feel? How does staff make me feel? And how does the physical environment make me feel? The third part of the project was to develop a leadership group to sustain the project, and for political reasons it wasn't done. Which comes, I guess one of my final points is that you need to keep on trying. Politics gets in the way, but don't let it stop you. So thank you. Any comments?
Yes. Is this unique? Is this a unique program you're developing, or are these
unique types? In California, it's not, because in California we have the voters in California passed a proposition 6 years ago to tax millionaires 1% of their income, and to put that money into innovative strength-based strategies in the public behavioral healthcare system. And so we have money for this. This was funded through the Mental Health Services Act, through prevention and early intervention dollars. This trauma-informed care initiatives in California are based in co-occurring conditions initiatives, mental health and substance use practice change initiatives, which are in many counties. And so there's a framework for it. So I think the unusual thing about this is that there's a lot of innovation going on in our county, and the bedrock of this is to validate that innovation and to build on what's already working. And so that was the piece, I think, that makes us sets us apart. Of course, the politics got on the way, but we're gonna circumvent it. We have a plan.
And that follow-up to that, is it cost-effective? Is this an expensive program in terms of educating people, getting people on board?
It's an in-kind expense. So it's run through people. We have a network of folks that are thought and practice leaders in trauma-informed care that feel very impassioned about it. And so they're going to be taking the Trauma 101 slideshow and discussions and workshops and doing it on their own time. So the idea is that it's low cost for a purpose, because we know that in this environment, our administration is not going to invest in this, even though it's clearly important, right? So good questions. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Now, it's been my total pleasure and privilege to work with clients as advocates and side by side with me. I'm the director of wellness recovery initiatives for the county, and I do strategic planning and change initiative work. It's because of them that we did this. They went to our training director and 2 years before the study and brought out Jackie McKinney and a few other people to our county to get our county to understand the important role of trauma. And then they lobbied our county leadership to do a project like this. And it just so happened that one of the deputy director's son had been mugged at college, and he already had some developmental issues. And so she said, yes, let's do this, kind of like that. And so they were involved in every part of the planning of the project, the design of the project, and on the advisory council. We have a very activist consumer group in our county. And we're very lucky for that. So yeah, it's very nothing about us without us in our county. Yeah, another question? Yeah. Good question. So this effort is lodged in our co-occurring conditions practice change collaborative, which I also facilitate. And I've invited in our primary care collaborators, and they're very happy to come in because they want to know what to do with the behavioral health people that are acting out in their waiting rooms, and we can give them answers, right? So right now, we're building relationships, and our hope is that we'll offer them a very concrete toolkit and a self-assessment and this kind of workshop that goes with a slide presentation, where we can find out who their leaders are who want to implement a trauma-informed care framework, and we'll work with them informally. So it's all about informal relationships at this level. We are funding behavioral health care positions in our FQHCs, so we're doing things that are more on the formalized contractual level, but we're also trying to affect the culture of how our relationships are like between us. Does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah.
It's a good question. Oh, you are.
And we funded an effort to support patient center medical recognition.
Oh.
This was supported by 800 health centers with a couple of funding to do patient center.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Right. No. And that's why trauma-informed care is so unique, because you don't have to be a behavioral health person to implement it. My presentation had the link to the toolkit. The toolkit is about things that make a lot of sense. And it isn't just behavioral health, it's basically creating an environment that is supportive and safe and engaging. So that, for instance, if you're doing an assessment on someone, you don't sit across the desk from them, you sit side by side, and the assessment is presented in language that's in English, in plain language, and it's done in a way that where the provider feels comfortable and the client feels comfortable. So there's, you have live plants in your office instead of dead plants. You've got your materials not only translated into languages, but you have things on the wall that remind the people of who they are. Because that's part of what trauma does to you. It knocks out your self-efficacy. You're disassociated from your strengths. So we need to do everything we can to help people feel grounded and emotionally regulated. And that is not rocket science. Peer support is a big part of this, as we know. So these techniques are cheap. They're just practice changes. And cultural changes, we know, and practice change can be, it's an art to know how to do it, but it isn't impossible, and it's not expensive. It's just you have to change the mindset of the people in your organization. We can talk if you want. I can find out specifically how this sort of thinking can be of use to you. Yeah. Any other? Are we good? We're good?